Number 114 from Whispers from Eternity. Demand for the realization of God's presence. O Divine Father, Thou art just behind my prayer. Why dost Thou seem so far away? Thou dost tremble in my feelings. Thy presence glimmers through the veil of my thoughts. Yet dost Thou seem so far away? Father, come. Remove Thy veil. Come, Father, come. Hear the voice of my prayer. I want to know Thee, to talk to Thee, to hear Thee speak to me. I want to pray to Thee and know that Thou dost hear my prayer. Show me the way that leads to Thee. The Gita verse that Swamiji includes in that reading, number 640, my devotee is never lost, is followed in sequence, of course, by the various things that do happen to you if one sets out stalwartly to realize God but dies without that realization actually coming. And he goes on to explain that you may go to the astral world and enjoy the beautiful, refined experience that your aspiration is in tune with. That might not be such a blessing, because the pleasure of the astral world and the fulfillment of the desire for beauty, for music, for harmony may be so deeply gratifying that the impetus for further spiritual growth goes on the shelf for a really long time. Or one may be so filled with zeal that even though desires prevent full God realization, the astral world feels like an unneeded vacation, and one incarnates immediately to get on with what we can do, because we can't make progress in the astral world alone until we have satisfied all of those desires that are related to the material world. So it's a vacation, but it's not a liberation because of the satisfaction of being there. You can stay for even hundreds of years, Swami says. So we come right back, and if we have good karma, if we're very sincere spiritually, it says we may be born into a prosperous family. Because if we're born into comfort and opportunity, it allows us, before we even reach our own independent adulthood life, we get to test out, or we get to fulfill, or we get to experience many desires that otherwise we have to devote a lifetime to trying to achieve. I was thinking about a friend of mine who was born into a prosperous family, a deeply devoted Ananda member now, since a young age. She was born into a prosperous and a very good family. In fact, she was adopted into it. And her mother died, however, quite young, when she was like in her mid-teens. And just because of who she was, she more or less became her father's hostess. He just gave her his credit cards, and she ran the household, enjoyed it thoroughly. None of this was even slightly oppressive to her. So by the time she was 20, she'd essentially already lived the life of a wealthy matron, had a beautiful home, had all the responsibility for it, and never had to do it, actually, in her adult life. She was able just to check it off the list. And so it can be for many people who are born into some level of prosperity. And it's notable that in the context of self-realization, Master's Path, and the way Swami has expressed it through Ananda, not everyone by any means, but the majority of people were born into comfort and relative privilege. It's because we have the good karma to not have to long for that experience. Rather, we just say, okay, I know what this is, just like my friend. I know what this is enough. I don't need it anymore. Swamiji often has mentioned that we learn from having our desires thwarted, but we actually learn more from having them fulfilled. Because when they're thwarted, usually there's always a piece of us that thinks, it's fine, I accept it, but I would have been happier if. Wouldn't it have been nice if? And so that attachment to duality keeps us oscillating inwardly, and we can never come to complete rest in God. But when the desire is fulfilled, as my friend had it in her life, then you say, well, that was lovely, but is that all? There must be more. There must be more. And so many of us who were born, if not to wealth, at least to comfort, were able at a very young age to say, well, I can see just what this looks like. And no, thank you. There has to be more. And then we find ourselves, many of us found ourselves at Ananda, you know, at quite an early age. My particular cohort and a huge cohort that's coming up after us, which is wonderful. I've been reading a very interesting book, which I highly recommend. It's called Transcendent Journey, and it's written by a Swami Gyanananda. He spells it J-N-A-N-A. It's only available in hardback from one source. It's a bit obscure. Gyanananda was a disciple of Master through an Indian lineage. He died not too many years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, and I had the opportunity to meet him several times when I went to India. I'm not even really going to talk about him. I'm going to talk about a character that he met. On March 2nd, 1952, in Switzerland, where his native country, his aunt gave him a copy of Autobiography of a Yogi. That date is very significant because that was the precise date when Master left his body. So Autobiography of a Yogi was handed to him. He was probably in his early 20s at that point, maybe a little younger, handed him the book. Immediately he recognized that it was his destiny, but Master had already gone. So at a certain point, he left his home in Switzerland, never to return, never to see his mother again, and began to hitchhike and walk to India, which he succeeded in doing and then spent the rest of his life there. And this book is about his travels around India and who he met, and you know, this was in the 50s. India was a very different place. And so the story that I want to tell is about a sadhu he met. He met many sadhus named Sirpad Baba, Choto Babaji, they called him, which meant that he translated as little grandfather. Because this man was 18 years old when Gyanananda met him. And it was very hard to get him to talk anything about his previous life, not that he had that much of it, but gradually over the years that they knew each other, he talked about it. And he was born in India. And I don't know what kind of a family, but I think it was a comfortable family. And at 8 years old, he was sitting in his schoolroom. And he was sitting toward the back of the class so he could see the whole class and the teachers. And the teacher was giving some kind of a lesson, but none of the children were paying any attention because outside the school window, in India they play this game where they have kites and they put pieces of broken glass on the strings, and then they have kite wars. And you try to cut your opponent's kite string, and that's the battle. And so outside the window, there was a very fierce kite battle going on, and all the little boys were, of course, much more interested in that than whatever the teacher was droning about, and there was a particularly intense fight going on between two kites, and finally somebody won, and the kite string was broken, and one of the little boys just inadvertently out of his excitement, you know, exclaimed, you know, that had happened. The teacher was standing right near him, and the child was not aware of that. When the child showed that he wasn't paying any attention to the teacher hit him across the head, which corporal punishment was not uncommon in those schools. It may still be common, I don't know. Struck him like that. The 8-year-old child, watching that, thought, what am I doing here? This is not education. I don't want to be in a place like this. So I don't know whether he got up immediately in the middle of class or waited till school ended. And he starts walking toward his home. And then he starts thinking, well, my parents went to a lot of trouble to find this school for me. If I tell them I don't like it, they're just going to find another one for me. He said, and I'm not going to like that one anymore. And he turned around and he walked away and he never went back. He never saw his parents again. He just left. And he went off to be a sadhu. He just went off and then he found his way. And he had, of course, he was little grandfather, he was Chota Babaji. He was not an ordinary child. And at 18, he was already just a great and remarkable saint. And he found those who would help him. Now, I'm reminded in this context of a story that Swamiji would often tell, that I think Master used to tell, about a woman who says, who goes to her brother and says, "I'm concerned about my husband. He talks about renouncing the world, and every year he gives up something else. You know, he won't eat sweets, or he gives up this particular thing, or he starts getting up a little early. Every year he's doing a little bit more." And the brother looks at his sister and says, "Oh, you don't have to worry about your husband. That's not how people renounce the world." And she said, "What do you mean?" She said, "This is how you do it." And he took off all his fancy clothes and he took one garment and ripped it into a loincloth and he tied it on. And he said, "This is how it's done." He said, "From now on, I regard you and all women as my mother." And he walked out the door and never came back. Now, that's what it really looks like. That's what it is to just turn your back on this world and not be in it anymore. Now, no one can pick up that kind of path unless you're called by God. And it's not even right to try. As Swamiji was saying once when he was talking to a group of our sadhakas, our householder religious order, and he described a degree of renunciation in his own life when, after he was thrown out of SRF and he had to make his life, his father was loaning him an automobile and then in a great generosity insisted on giving it to Swamiji. And Swamiji was telling us this story 40 years later, and he was weeping when he talked to us about the fact that he had to accept that car from his father. He needed it, and he couldn't be so rude to his father. He had to accept it. But talking to us, he was weeping because he had to accept that car, and he had walked away from everything. And now he was compelled to go back into the world, and the pain of it was almost unbearable to him all those decades later. And we're listening to him, and I don't even know where to put this. You know, we're working so hard to have a car, and we hope to get a better one. You know, maybe the next one will be a Prius, and maybe after that we can get a Tesla. You know, it's just like we're hoping for all these things just to make our little tiny world less unpleasant for us. And Swami's weeping because his father generously gave him a car. And this little boy at 8 years old just walks out, and Swami Gyanananda just walks out, just walks away. I mean, you have to be called by God. You can't force that. But we also have to understand what it is that we're dealing with. You know, we hear this story. I hate this verse, and I always get it because I'm always having to talk at Christmas, and I have these poor virgins, and we have these poor five virgins, and all I can think about is just how heartbroken they must have been. Just because their whole life they've been waiting for the bridegroom, and then the bridegroom comes and they blinked and he just cast them out. And it feels so unfair. But then Swami balances it by offering us Krishna's words. "It's all right. Even if something happens, And you disappoint yourself. You're not able to be who you wanted to be. It's all right. I'm not going to abandon you." Because that's the terrible fear that all of us live with, is that, you know, no matter what I do, something's going to come, and it's just not going to come out the way that I hoped it would come out. And then the world supports that. Everything in our life experience supports it. We're always in a struggle between the upward and the downward moving energy. But even the great souls are there. Ram Gopal Muzumdar, the sleepless saint, that Master describes in Autobiography of a Yogi. And this man has, you know, spends 20 hours a day meditating. That's all that he does. And he's wondering whether or not he's pleased God. And a story like that is, on one hand, exhilarating, and the other, again, what am I supposed to do with that? How am I supposed to be able to measure up to that? And that's what always frightens me about this story about these virgins. Like, did they know they were being foolish, or did they think they were doing the right thing? And now, I mean, after all this panic that I'm offering to you, this is not really like, oh, and now Merry Christmas, let's sing joy to the world, you know? But all sides of it exist simultaneously. And that's why so few people persevere on the spiritual path. I mean, this a very un-Christmas-like topic, why do devotees fail, or whatever it is, what is spiritual failure? I don't know if it was this one or something very similar to it. It used to always come out on Swami's birthday, so we actually rearranged the topic so that we just didn't every year have to say, Happy birthday, Swamiji, and here's what happens to the miserable curs who never make it on the spiritual path. I mean, it was just like, it's not much better in December. Maybe we could put it like, I don't know what month it would look good in. I don't think it would look good in any month, but it is a real part of it. I remember there was a time, and I don't know whether Swami was doing this just for me or whether there were others in the room who needed it. The song that is one of our favorites, you know, walk like a man, even though you walk alone, why court approval once the road is known, you know, and it just goes on like that. Swami had an alternate line in there for a while. What if they despise you? Go on alone. And I just constantly did the dopiest things when I lived with Swami. I can't believe it when I look back on it. I mean, among the many, many, many lessons I learned from him was how to put up with an idiot because of the way he put up with me. Anyway. I had more courage than intelligence. That's all. Like, no, I didn't have any courage. I was reckless. I was just reckless. But he's doing this, let them despise you, go on alone. I said, Swami, that's a horrible verse. It's just like, you can't have a stand up there and sing, let them despise you. It was just ghastly. And he just looked at me. You know, there's moments over 45 years that I remember. He just looked at me. And he had this way. Especially when I did something really stupid. He had this way. There would be no ripple. There wouldn't be a ripple of, well, she's an idiot, but she has potential, so I'll keep working with her. You know, there would be just like none of that. He would be absolutely neutral. No vibration of judgment, no vibration of impatience, nothing. But he would tell me the truth. There would also be no, oh, there, little girl, none of that. No sympathy, but no judgment. Just, this is a fact. He just looked at me, it was one of those moments. He just looked at me and said, but they will. You know, I'm 23 or 24 years old, nobody's despised me. In fact, you know, I'm kind of cute. People like me as a general rule. I can ruffle feathers. God knows I could ruffle feathers. But, you know, overall, nobody had ever despised me. But they will. And what will you do then? Why are you on the spiritual path? Are you on it because you can just kind of enjoy yourself and then the bridegroom is still going to take you in? Or do you have to be prepared that, you know, much will happen? I know there was a young man in India that Swamiji wanted to come and he asked him to come live in the ashram. When Swami first moved there, he wanted him to come live with him. And the man said, but if I did that, my mother would be so disappointed. And of course, this was India. That was a pretty big deal. It's always a big deal, but it was a bigger deal over there. And Swami actually said, sooner or later, we all have to disappoint our mothers. And he said it like that. But when I published it in the book, he said, because he wanted to give credit to other mothers, he said, we all have to be prepared to disappoint our mothers. We have to be prepared not to flinch. But I don't think he really meant, although sometimes it was true, we do have to just say to our families, I'm sorry, I know that what you're expressing, you perceive it as love. But, when Swamiji himself, I was listening to him say this in a talk just recently, his father never understood or approved of what he was doing. He said his father wanted him to be an electrical engineer. It's just a preposterous suggestion. And it was, of course, there was no chance that Swami would do that. But after Swami had chosen the life with Master, his father really never completely reconciled to it. That's putting it mildly, but he never did. He never understood it. He was a very good man. He was a really good man, but he just didn't understand the life that Swami had lived. Although, interestingly, after his father died, someone who would know said that his father was quite proud of what he'd accomplished, but for some reason was never able to say it directly to his son. And I think after his father died, Swamiji felt a very different energy from him. But at some point, his father started really, criticizing what Swamiji was doing, and Swami just wrote him a letter. You know, the same way that Master spoke to his father. Swami said, you are my father, he said, but God has been my father for all eternity. Do not ask me to choose, because if I have to choose, of course I will choose God. And his father then never said another word after that. Do not ask me to choose, because of course I will choose God. We may not have to do that, but we have to be ready to do that. And we have to be exhilarated even by that thought, even though different parts of us will pull in many different directions. That boy sadhu that I was speaking about, for a period of time, he spent time somewhere deep in the forest with some ancient sadhu who trained him. And he talked about what he described as an actual force that began to compel him. Basically what he was saying, compel him to move with the spirit and not with the ego. And this man is talking at the age of 18, and he says, I can talk about it easily now, he said, but it was very, very difficult when it was happening. He was just at war in the Battle of Kurukshetra. He was having it right there within himself, between everything that the ego keeps wanting and the fact that sooner or later we have to be prepared to give up everything for God. But going back to Swamiji weeping when he talks about accepting that car to that group of people, Swami then said to them at the end of that, he said, don't even try to live the way I'm living. He said, you wouldn't be able to do it, and it wouldn't even be appropriate for you to try. And now I think about that a lot. It wouldn't be appropriate for us to try, but aren't we supposed to do this? No, we're not supposed to do anything. Swami puts it elsewhere. Spiritual growth, he says, must be relaxed and natural. It has to grow like a seed from within the heart, and we have to nourish the plant. We have to give the plant what the plant actually needs. We can't give it something that we think would be better. And then we have to come to peace with that reality. We have to just come to peace with, it's not appropriate for me to try. This is what renunciation looks like. I'm 8 years old and I think the school is awful. I'm just going to walk out. Oh, my parents. Oh, well, I'll forget about them too. And thrive on that. You see, by their fruits you shall know them. You have to thrive on that. Yanananda walked away and it nourished him. This young Chotto Babaji, he walked away and he flourished in that. Because, extreme as it might have looked to others, it was actually relaxed and natural for them. So this balance point, this is the balance point that we're all trying to find on our spiritual life, which is to be sure that we're doing everything we can, but that we're not setting goals for ourselves that are not relaxed and natural and appropriate for us. But then when God does call, or more profoundly, when God calls and we don't answer properly, we have to have the courage to just persevere. My devotee is never lost. It doesn't make any difference. I owe everything to Swami. It's as simple as that. But when I think of how he modeled continuously, and Swami, I was listening to what a Swami giving a beautiful talk about what I learned from Yogananda. It was from an Ananda Village talk. I just found it online. And he just said over and over again, Master loved us. Master loved us and believed in us and always encouraged us. And I'll say from my own experience, because I'm sure it was true for Master, and never flinched at our limitations, never even perceived them as such. Just, okay, this is what's needed now. This is what we have to do. That's what Swami said to me once when I was literally just weeping my heart out because this horrible attitude of mine, which I thought I had transcended, just came back like a wild monster, and I thought it was gone. And, you know, just everything about that was just profoundly disappointing. And Swami's response, well, he said, now you know. You thought you were over it, so you weren't putting out any energy, and now you know you have more work to do. You know, just like past the crumpets. It was just like nothing else afterwards. Like here, I'm having this huge existential crisis. And Swami just thinks, so I mean, like, what did you expect, girl? Are you an avatar? Well, no, not actually. He didn't say that to me. That's what I said to myself. Swami just said, so? And that's the razor's edge that we walked. So there are those poor dopey virgins, you know, are out locked outside the bridal chamber. It's like that was like a bad moment. But the most important moment is the moment after. It's like, do they just break their lamps and just say, to heck with this whole thing? Or they say, well, that didn't work. You know, what comes next? The secret of success, the secret of prosperity, Swami told me, was creativity. I didn't get that at first, but now I really do understand it. If one thing doesn't work, you just find something else. And if that doesn't work, then you try that. And if that doesn't work, you keep going. And sooner or later, it will work, because my devotee is never lost. And so if this little plan and this little idea and this little skating the edge and this little thinking I could just like just keep a few things for myself, you know, just one attachment, two or three little ones, nobody really knows. And when that doesn't work, what we do next, that's what matters. And what we do next is, well, okay, now you know. And Krishna promises us, just keep picking yourself up every time. Just dry your tears, lift your head, square your shoulders. I'd love to see Swami who would go, double breath, you know, like that. Go forward as if nothing has happened, because nothing really has happened. All that happens is a little time pass, and they tell us that when it's all over, we don't even know, we don't even feel the time. Seems like a lot now, but it's actually nothing. These are remarkable promises, remarkable promises. And they're our raft over the ocean of delusion. So that's what the Bible warns us, and then the Gita reassures us. And all the masters, they have our backs, guys. They really know. They know what they're doing. And if we just keep listening, they'll take us home. Bless you.
mercy and grace, grant us thy vision, grant us thy peace. Our love receive, though blindly we pray, silently guide our thoughts when we stray. How many years so proud of our wisdom, turning from God, we've wandered alone. So many but madness. Now our souls come.